Hi, I'm Lauren.
And I'm Charlotte. Our pronouns are she, her.
This is Demyth Turns the Page.
Our special episodes where we fall in love.
We get romantic.
And we get gooey-eyed with Emily Hauser.
Hi, Emily. So this is a first for us. We haven't had anyone on who's done an anthology of different stories before, and yours from the digital stuff that we've seen is just so stunning. So thank you for coming on and just feeling all the feels with us.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get started into your book, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, of course. So my name is Emily Hauser. I'm a senior lecturer in classics and ancient history at the University of Exeter. But I'm also an author and passionate about making ancient myths and stories as accessible as possible to a wide audience. So I've written three novels that retell the stories of the women of Greek myth. And the book that we're going to be talking about today, Ancient Love Stories, is a retelling of an anthology of different true love stories from across history.
And what kind of books do you like to read?
Oh, God. I mean, if I gave a true answer to that, I'd say the books that I have to read are all of the kind of dull academic monographs that nobody actually reads, except for me, apparently. But like, talking about what I like to read in my spare time, I adore historical fiction. And so that for me was the kind of entry point into writing the novels myself, because I just love all kinds of historical fiction, just getting immersed into the past and kind of losing myself in different time periods. And then, you know, I sort of also like your classic beach reads, just sort of a good romance and a bit of a laugh. That's always fun, just to relax from the heavy classical tomes.
This book is fully illustrated and so gorgeous. And your artist is, how do you pronounce it, Sander?
I think it's Sander. I've never actually met him in person, but I think it's Sanderberg, yeah.
So what was the process of compiling the book together? Did you work directly with them, or is it like the usual cover process where you just get given kind of final art?
Oh no, it was really interactive. And I mean, this was so lovely and something I really appreciated about the process of working with Sander. And I should say, this is my first experience of doing an illustrated book. So I don't know kind of how it measures up in terms of kind of what the normal process is, but I just loved how interactive it was. So the way that it worked was I was approached with the kind of idea of a kind of a skeleton idea of a book of ancient love stories by the press who's publishing it, which is Bonnier, who kind of specializes in children's and young adults books. And something I'd really wanted to do is to kind of write for a younger generation. And so they'd kind of seen that was something that was in my writing, but they'd already had Sander in their mind as the artist for the book. So it was already a kind of match that they had made between Sander's amazing kind of very, very classical, very textural style and my writing. So that was kind of amazing from the get-go. And then what I did was I wrote the book, and Sander had already kind of, there were a couple of stories that they'd had an idea that they would like to have included. So Sander illustrated one of those, and it was just stunning. It's the scene of the Sacred Band of Thebes, and maybe we'll get into the story later, but it's just like this stunning battle scene that's a full double page spread, and there's dust swirling and men lunging and stabbing and people dying. It's great. And I just got a real sense for kind of the tactile nature of the way that he illustrates. And then as I kind of was producing the stories, he was coming up with sketches. It started as sketches. And then kind of we worked together. So if there were sort of elements that I felt that would be good to include, and particularly because of my classical academic background, I was able to sort of say, well, we could do a reference to this work of art or a reference to this kind of narrative. And he was so open to that. It was really brilliant. But then, of course, at the same time, he just had so many great ideas that it really just kind of was very organic.
How did you feel with it being a collaboration? Were you excited? Was it nerve-wracking?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think particularly in, at least in the humanities and academia, and the things are changing now, we have more collaborative projects. But if you think about the kind of traditional academic, they often kind of work alone, sort of the same with a traditional novelist, I guess. And what was kind of exciting about this was that opportunity. I think I really liked the fact that we were working in different media to try and achieve different emotional effects. And so it kind of felt like it wasn't the case where, you know, in some cases you can feel like maybe you're treading on each other's toes, and this didn't feel like that at all because he was just bringing a whole different dimension to the book. So honestly, I just feel like it was really enriching. And I mean, Lauren, you already mentioned like just how gorgeous it is, but it just feels like such a thing of beauty. And I think that was the thing that really, for me, I mean, I obviously believe that words are beautiful, but I think there's something about an image that just, I mean, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words, all that. It was just so immediately captivating. And that was really exciting.
We know that you are hella educated in classics, so I have a very serious and important question to ask you.
Okay.
Charlotte's laughing because she knows what's coming. We did an episode where we picked a love story each for Valentine's Day from Greek mythology, and we retold it. And as I went through my story, I started to have doubts about how romantic it was and started to feel like this is actually quite creepy. And it's a story of Pygmalion.
Okay, I was just going to say that pretty much sums up most of Greek myth.
It does. Is it, in your opinion, is it a romantic story of him falling in love with his statue Galatea, or is he just a weird, creepy man? So I want your TED talk on this because I'm still not sure. So we need an expert to help us.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, no. So for people who don't know the story of Pygmalion and Galatea, he has created a sculpture that is so beautiful that he falls in love with it. And eventually the statue actually kind of metamorphoses and becomes a real woman. I think it's incredibly creepy. And I think that probably is like where, to be honest, even if I think about the ancient texts, I think that they felt it was creepy. So one of the most kind of famous retellings of the story is the Roman poet Ovid. And I think he's really into exposing the creepiness of the male gaze. And this is like the ultimate male creep, who has just created a female object that he wants to stare at and objectify. And then the only way that he can kind of realize those fantasies is by making her come real. But I'm really glad that you mentioned that story, because that actually is a good example of a point where I fed back into the illustrations and kind of used this story of Pygmalion and Galatea, because there's a one love story in the collection about the emperor, the Roman emperor Hadrian, who was absolutely besotted with this young man called Antinous. And Antinous died in very strange circumstances. He was probably drowned in the Nile, and Hadrian just basically spent the rest of his life kind of obsessing and mourning over this boy. And he created so much statuary of him that he is one of the most sculpted people from the ancient world. So like, you know, everywhere you see statues of Antinous. And I was like, this just really feels a little bit like Pygmalion, that he's trying to kind of reach to this lover who is gone and is dead, and he's trying to do that. So we have a really lovely reference to that, where he's kind of embracing the statue of Antinous and gazing into his eyes. And I do think that attempt to reach someone who has been so powerful erotically in your life and yet is absent, I think that is a theme that really resonates in that story.
You can tell by the really awkward look on my face right now, I actually thought that story was quite romantic.
Oh, Hadrian and Antinous.
Yeah.
But I think it is romantic, you know, and I think okay, it is good. Romantic. I think the Pygmalion and Galatea one, I think is not romantic because it's him sculpting an object and then the object kind of needing to be realized in order to realize his desires. Antinous was a young man who, it seems, at least in some way reciprocated Hadrian's passion, and they did have years where they really kind of had a golden time together. It's more that then that kind of turned into this kind of obsessive grief after his death. And I think that kind of mirrors the Pygmalion story. But yeah, I think when Antinous was alive, then, and I mean, there's all kinds of theories as well about how Antinous actually died and whether, you know, that Hadrian actually even had a hand in it. So it kind of gets a bit twisted towards the end.
I don't think he did, because he created, like you said, so much statuary for him that I think that's a bit twisted.
I think it is twisted, and I think it's the kind of thing that always comes up around kind of, you know, scandalous murder mystery stories. You know, was it suicide? Was it murder? Was it some kind of weird sacrificial rite, even, some people have suggested? I think that does twist it. And I think, yeah, it's nice to focus on the fact that so much beauty and so much art came out of this kind of brief moment of passion between an all-powerful Roman emperor and a young boy from the Roman provinces. I think that's a pretty amazing story. So yeah, I've definitely kind of tried to focus on that angle, which I think is the one that's worth telling.
We don't have to look to works of fiction to find tales of true love. The pages of history are crammed with stories about love that are quite literally true, and many of them are among the greatest love stories ever told. Ancient Love Stories brings together some of the most remarkable romances in history, from tales of fearless queens and besotted emperors to men who died fighting for the men they loved. These accounts of passion, jealousy, hope, and longing show that perhaps little has changed over the last 3,000 years. Love, above all, has endured.
We did an episode with Diane Rea, who translated Sappho. So we opened your book, and starting off with us is Sappho, and we loved it. That absolutely thrilled us. And you know, you open this book about ancient love stories, and there is Sappho in all her glory. She's on the cliffs. So let's get into what we think is the most important of questions. Why, when we have a woman who writes beautiful poetry that includes sexual desire for other women, do you think she became someone who throws herself off a cliff over unrequited love for a man?
Oh, so powerful, so important. And yeah, it really kind of roils me up. And I actually try and address it in the story, because it's just sort of the fact that you try and turn this woman who writes some of not just the most powerful love poetry between women, but the most powerful love poetry of all time. And then to turn her into someone that she just wasn't, which is not only heterosexual. So for listeners who don't know, the myth or the story went that Sappho died because she committed suicide and sort of took a frenzied jump off some cliffs into the sea because a young ferryman called Phaon decided that he didn't like her. And that just is so kind of patently absurd. It's kind of been studied in a lot of ways, but it seems to me that it's obviously an attempt to contain someone who was different and who was talking about different kinds of love. And instead, what the later tradition does is it turns her into a woman who could only have affection for man, who can't even achieve that affection, right? So she doesn't even manage to get that relationship. So she's a failed heterosexual lover. And then, because she's failed, she does the ultimate female act in Greek tragedy, which is to commit suicide, which is what basically all women do in Greek tragedy. When they can't do anything, they just go inside the house and commit suicide. And so I feel like it's just putting her into this role, which it is just so different from the real poet. It becomes part of her afterlife, but it's not who she was. And when you read her poetry, you can see it.
And you mentioned, for some people, or for people that aren't super familiar with her poetry, that she has names of some of her female lovers in what we have. Obviously, there could be more in the work of hers that was lost. And it just does seem so suggestive of her own female desire. So why do you think that by academics that came later, it's just been reduced to footnotes and she has been heterosexualized?
Well, there was a long tradition within the discipline of classics of kind of trying to normatize Sappho and sort of clean her up, if we might put it that way. So to make it sort of palatable for the kind of often male readers who were reading this kind of intensely erotic private female world, as a way to try and kind of make it understandable, the way, particularly in translation, the way that Sappho's lyrics were translated, they were translated in such a way that it wasn't made clear that she was talking about a woman. And so the most famous example is the first fragment, which is the only complete poem of Sappho we have, right? Like, let's just stop there and just acknowledge that, because that is crazy given how important she was in the ancient world and how much other poetry by men has survived, that only one complete poem has survived from her. That really testifies to the kind of the culture of female silencing in antiquity and afterwards. But in that first poem, she talks about a woman, and in the Greek, it becomes clear that she's talking about a woman because the words that she uses around that woman are feminine. But you can translate that in English without that, because we don't kind of have gendered participles and so on. So you can kind of remove that. And translators did that. So they took away the fact that she was talking about a woman. And I think that that was part of a kind of, yeah, a desire to streamline her and make her into something that could be consumed by particularly 19th century scholars. But there's been a real pushback. And I'm sure if you were talking to Diane Rea, she will have talked about this as well, that translations are really kind of trying to make strides to acknowledge the, and I would say that it's not just about women. It seems like it's a sort of broader erotic experience that Sappho is celebrating. And I think translations are really trying to incorporate that now.
Yeah, she did say that, because she'd done an original translation years ago, and then some new fragments had been found and she'd done an updated one, and she said that she felt a bit bolder with some of the choices that she made this time around, and with the language that she chose, that it's more obvious.
And I think that's true. I think even in the kind of, I can't remember when her first translation came out, was it in the 90s? And her other one was more recent, a couple of years ago, I think. So even in that last kind of couple of decades, I do feel like there has been a shift in kind of the way that we talk about Sappho, the way that we kind of acknowledge and celebrate that erotic experience, and the way that she presents it. So for me, that was so important that we, and this is kind of really a thread that runs through the whole of ancient love stories, is trying to kind of turn the kind of normal narratives we tell about the past on their head. You know, our normal way of thinking about a love story is boy meets girl. Well, let's start it with a story about girl meets girl. Let's change the narrative that history has always been about men and start it with a fabulous female poet who really changed the way that we talked about love forever. And I feel like that was kind of really programmatic for me.
You mention in the book, gaps in Sappho's poetry allow us to imagine her story for ourselves. Do you think that's why she's still so popular or influential today?
I think it's one reason. I think there are a lot of different reasons. The first, and I kind of don't want to underplay this, is that she's a fantastic poet, and so I think that that's like important to acknowledge, because it's often easy to kind of say that about the men, particularly if you're talking about Homer. Everyone kind of talks about the poetry, but Sappho is an amazing poet. She's an amazing wordsmith. But I do think that there is something, particularly when we're talking about Sappho's afterlife, and we kind of talked a little bit about the negative side of Sappho's afterlife, right? So we talked about how men in particular kind of created this crazy imaginary of her leaping off the cliffs, but also in a kind of positive way, I think there has been, particularly lately, as women writers have really kind of started to look back to the classical past, there is a huge power in the fact that Sappho is kind of standing there as the kind of originary poet of as a woman of the Western tradition. And there's a kind of a huge power that you could still look back to that. And so I always think of Anne Carson's translation, If Not Winter, where she just leaves some of the pages kind of almost all blank, and all you'll just have like a single word, and it will be like a very strange word, like, I don't know, napkin ring or something like that. But it's like this one fragment that we have of Sappho, but it gestures to the fact of all of that kind of space around her that can be welcoming, and it could be a place where we can start to kind of create new stories about the past and new futures too.
One of the fragments that we talked about with Diane was
dripping linen,
and
yeah,
we both had different ideas of what that could be. And I took it as a sexual thing.
Okay.
And that did things to me, like those two words, because of the imagery that it evokes of like female arousal. Why did it take me so long to think of that word? Just it's
been a long day.
Yeah, it does things to you from just two words. And that is something that is so powerful.
Totally right. I think that can almost be more powerful because it allows the space for you to interpret it. I think particularly with the kind of canonical authors who are so preserved, there's kind of less space to, whereas, you know, this with two words, you can really insert yourself in any way, and you can take it from so many different angles. You can just respond to it on an emotional level. And in a way, you're kind of freed to do that because there's no story around it. So I kind of love hearing your response to that, because it's so funny, because my brain immediately goes to the kind of academic technique, which is that they used to put oil and scented oil on their clothes. And that's particularly in Homer, who was, you know, just slightly before Sappho. He'll often talk about shining clothes, and they used to kind of rub those, that scented oil into their clothes. So it makes me think of kind of clothes that are so wealthy and luxurious that they're like literally kind of dripping over. But it's just, I love that there are so many different angles you can take to it.
And you're not going to know who is right, because there's nothing until the rest of the poem is found.
Until we dig something up from the desert, you know, yeah. And to be honest, also, I don't think with poetry it's ever about who's right. And I think particularly with such a kind of physical response as you had, Lauren, I think that that response is always justified. You know, like, I think that is amazing, that capacity of poetry to do that to us. And I think that's never going to be disproved.
The next question, I purely just want your opinion. In your fantasy about Sappho, is she reunited with Anactoria?
Oh my goodness. Yes. In my fantasy world, yes, she is. I love the kind of, so basically Sappho's story arc is that she was actually part of a quite influential clan on her island of Lesbos. And that word Lesbos is what gave rise, and really Sappho is what gave rise to the modern word lesbian. But she gets exiled, her family get into some kind of political trouble. And I just love the idea that she kind of came back, and Anactoria, who is one of the women who is mentioned in the poems, is there waiting for her. And one of the reasons I kind of like to think that is there's one of the fragments that I talk about in Ancient Love Stories, which is my favorite fragment of Sappho, where she just talks about going on this journey, and she compares her journey to Helen's journey, Helen of Troy, and that kind of feeling of distance, but then also eventually coming home, that longing to come home, and particularly that association of home with the person you love. And she talks about Anactoria, missing Anactoria. I just think that's so powerful. So yes, I would love to think that there was that reunion at some point.
You're going to need to help with some pronunciation here.
Of course.
We have a few kind of romantic pairings that we wanted to talk about. Amatis and Nebuchadnezzar.
Mm-hmm. Fab, 100%.
Good. It's going to get worse, I'm sure. But we need to talk about these two. So firstly, what could a lover build for you the way he built a garden for her? Like, what's your equivalent? Is it the bookcases that your husband built?
The bookcases. I mean, we just, like, that's so funny, because we just started this conversation talking about, I'm sitting in front of some bookcases, which my husband built to kind of house our personal library. And he put my books in there. And that's just such a kind of, yeah, an act of dedication and love. I think that is amazing. And I love that comparison. I mean, I think with Amatis and Nebuchadnezzar, their story, so to kind of give background to the story, this is the kind of history behind the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and that kind of one of the wonders, seven wonders of the ancient world. And the story goes that it was built by one of the Babylonian kings because his wife came from really far away, and she came from this really kind of lush mountainous land. And so he tried to kind of recreate that by creating a tiered garden on steps, or sort of stepped tiers, which is why it's hanging, they're sort of trailing down. And it was a way of her being able to reconnect to her home. And I think that just seems like such a kind of momentous gesture in a world where often that kind of emotional level wasn't really often acknowledged between lovers, and also between a person for their home. So I think that's really powerful. I mean, just thinking about kind of what an analogy could be today, I don't know, because I do think that what's really powerful about that story is also the home part of it, that she was missing where she belonged, and he tried to make a place where she could belong. And maybe the bookcases are a great analogy, because it's about creating a home, and you know, books create a home more than anything else does. There's a great quote from, I think it's Cicero, who is a great thinker and lawyer from ancient Rome. And he says, a room without books is like a body without a soul.
That's a great line.
It's gorgeous, isn't it? Yeah. And that's so true. So maybe this was an act of soul giving.
I'm going to use that every time I get books in the post in future. And my partner's like, another one, do you really need it?
There you go.
What Cicero said.
Yeah.
When I went to New York, my friend and I went to the Strand bookshop, and I've got a fridge magnet. I can't remember who said it, but it says, if you go home with someone and they don't have books, don't fuck them.
Love it. Amazing. I mean, you know, you could use Lauren's, you could use Charlotte's, whichever, you know, both of them have the same purpose.
When you're drunk at 3 a.m. though, you're not going to be thinking about if they got books.
No, that's true. Or remembering Cicero. Maybe, yeah, I think that would probably be a bad idea. Having seen his statues.
Do we or can we know if the Hanging Gardens ever existed? Because as you say, they're the only, you know, ancient wonders of the world that has never actually been found.
No, that's right. Yeah, I think it's really difficult. We have testimony from ancient historians that does kind of describe them with quite a lot of kind of scientific detail. I think also there's been arguments, particularly with this kind of, again, looking back at what the ancient historians say, they give details on the kind of stepped tiers, and that is a very prominent feature of Babylonian architecture. So they do seem to kind of resonate with what you would expect, whether it was for a wife by a Babylonian king. Yeah, I think that's probably going to be hard to say. But then I kind of like to maybe extend that hope and also maybe that trust in the ancient sources, because a lot of the other ones that maybe we might also be inclined not to believe, you know, sort of the Colossus at Rhodes or the Alexandrian Lighthouse, and we know that they did exist. So maybe there's a reason they were called wonders, that they kind of stir up that kind of emotion in us. And it's nice to kind of hold out that trust that they did exist.
And is that something that adds to the magic of it? You know, the fact that no one's ever found them.
I love that. And I think that's so right. And I think that kind of it testifies to a thread that runs through ancient love stories, which is not just the romance between couples, but it's also the romance of that connection to the past. And it goes back a little bit to what we were saying about Hadrian and Antinous. If there's some kind of nostalgia there, and there's some kind of yearning that approximates it onto that kind of feeling that you have for someone, that kind of delicious desire to kind of find the past, and yet you're never going to uncover it. I think that is so exciting.
We have a story that is essentially a political match between the Babylonians and the Assyrians. We have a woman who travels hundreds of miles to marry a man that she's never met, which is not romantic at all. But then he builds the gardens after she arrives. It's not in preparation, it's after she arrives. So do you think this is why it becomes a love story? There must have been some kind of connection between them for him to want to do this for her. It's not like it was a show of wealth to his new wife before she came.
That's interesting. So I'm not actually sure, and I'd have to go back and check the sources about the chronology, whether we're actually told about the chronology of when it happened. But I think that what is important is that she wasn't Assyrian. I think she was actually a Mede. So she was from Persia, kind of to the east. So I think that so she's from Media. But he's just taken down the Assyrian Empire. So maybe that's kind of because they're quite closely linked, because obviously he wants to make the alliance with her against the Assyrians. So, So Media isn't to the east. It's to the west, I think. But anyway, she's coming from far away. And in these kinds of dynastic alliances, because this is an alliance that is being made between two kings, it's being forged between two massive empires, and you wouldn't expect this to be a love match. It's quite dismal in its romantic kind of offerings, as you were saying. And I think maybe, yeah, that's what's exciting, is that something came out of it, even though you wouldn't expect it. And it's a little bit like maybe, and that's why, again, the metaphor of the garden is so powerful, because it's a little bit like when you plant a seed and you don't know if something is going to come and it does. And that kind of flowering and blossoming of a relationship is just it's such a beautiful metaphor.
And as you said, he's trying to create a home and a space for her.
Yeah, exactly. In a place where, you know, it's kind of maybe inconceivable now, but like, you know, she would probably have gone there knowing that she would never go back home. And we do have from a lot earlier, but I'm thinking of this, there's a kind of stash of letters from Egypt from like the 14th to the 13th centuries BC, where there are letters between princesses and their or parents sending letters to Egyptian pharaohs, and the princesses have been kind of basically bartered off for alliances. And it's clear that they're kind of, they are now just one more diplomatic link. And it's just, it's really quite sad to see. So I think this is maybe quite heartening that you can imagine a better future for these kinds of women.
The next question we'd like to go down is the Sacred Band of Thebes and the Lovers of Pompeii.
Mm-hmm.
We also covered the Sacred Bands of Thebes in an episode, so we're absolutely thrilled to see them get their moment again, them pop up in your book.
Love it. Yeah, they're amazing, and more people should know about them. So I'm really glad that you guys talked about them as well.
When graves are discovered, what do you think we're looking for to tell us about the people inside? Or what can we find that will give us information about the people that are there?
Well, that's a huge question, because that is becoming a richer and richer resource now that science is advancing. So, you know, previously when graves were first discovered, and in sort of the early stages of archaeology and sort of the 19th century, when archaeology as a discipline was really starting, a lot of it was really just about kind of finding grave goods. And it was quite kind of crude in that, like, you know, if you found a grave with a sword, it meant that you'd found a man. And if you found a grave with a necklace, it meant you found a woman. And it was that was kind of what you were doing. And now it's become so much more nuanced and so much more rich that you can really get information from the kind of the smallest fragments. Obviously, we've got the incredible advances of ancient DNA, which can tell us so much about ancient people. You can look at the wear and tear of their teeth to learn about nutrition. So there are huge amounts of things you can do. I mean, obviously, what was so exciting about this particular grave with the Sacred Band of Thebes, this is a kind of story that we know from ancient history of this band of lovers. Pairs of male lovers who were matched up with each other, because the theory was that they would do anything for each other and they would therefore fight to the death. And it was said that they were buried in a mass grave together on the battle plain where they fell eventually. And I think with this, what's incredible is that matching. When that grave was discovered, the matching between something that sounds so legendary as to be almost mythical, and then the reality of a grave that is so kind of physical and kind of macabre and yet moving, and then the final detail that some of the skeletons had actually been placed there holding hands. I think that just, it kind of creates, it's a little bit like what we were talking about narrative and image. Here we've got the story, the legend, but then we've got the kind of the physicality of these bodies and what their affection for each other really meant, that they wanted to be close together in death. And that is just so moving.
I guess we should be grateful that it was found at a time when they could understand what it was, rather than maybe finding it in the 19th century, where they would have seen them holding hands and maybe not understood that it was two men.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, in a way that the grave itself was stumbled upon by in the 19th century by a man, but then it was like later that they kind of actually found the skeleton. So yeah, I think it's sort of, and this is the difficulty, is that we're always, our methods and our assumptions are always developing. So how much of the past do we uncover, or do we wait until someone comes along in future who has better methodologies? And I mean, this is a little bit what's happening in Pompeii. I don't know if you guys know, but a third of the site is unexcavated because they basically very wisely realized that technology is going to improve. And so we need to kind of wait and hold our horses. But like, when it's something that is sensational as this, and especially when it's something that ties into a piece of history that is so kind of, yeah, sensational and moving, I think it's kind of hard to stop.
Why do you think that no one ever created an army like that again?
I think it came out of a very particular historical context that as far as I know, and my knowledge may be limited, but as far as I know, wasn't kind of found in the same way in subsequent years. So particularly in classical Greece, there was a setup where it was completely normalized and actually encouraged for older males to take younger male lovers. There were words for those roles in the relationships, and it was really seen as not just kind of a socially approved form of love, but actually like really beneficial. It was kind of a form of education for the young boys, a way of kind of coming into society. And that I just don't feel like we've seen that kind of on that level. And I think the fact that it was just so obvious to them that you could have these really deep, meaningful romantic relationships between men, and these men were also going into war. I mean, this goes all the way back to even to Homer's Iliad with Patroclus and Achilles. You know, there's these kinds of deep relationships between men. And I feel like that's something that the Greeks really explored. And that's why they were the ones to kind of do this experiment.
You mean Achilles and Patroclus weren't just cousins?
They weren't just cousins. Shock horror, you know?
I know.
Sorry, Troy, 2004.
Amazing.
And look, talking about the lovers of Pompeii, what is it about that that just seems so romantic, and Pompeii in general? Like, it's a place that captivates us so much. And is that because so much has been preserved and we can actually see sort of ash cocoons of the bodies, and it just feels so much more moving, even seeing pictures, but to be able to actually go and see it as we both have, it just captures us so much more.
It really does. I think, you know, this maybe goes back to that kind of almost romantic feeling of wanting to grasp onto the past. And I think in Pompeii, you get closer to that than you do almost anywhere else, because of the kind of sudden violent end of the eruption, you have everything there. So you have walls that are being half painted with pots of paint knocked over as someone ran away. As you said, you have these kind of really gruesome sort of encasements of these bodies where we can see them frozen in the last moments of their death to such a degree that you can see studs on their belts and sandals. You know, it's so vivid, it almost feels like you're there. So I think that's the attraction, is that we sort of all want, I think, at least, and maybe this is just me as a historian, but like a portal back into the past. Like, how interesting would that be? And I mean, I know Doctor Who goes back to Pompeii, so like we all want it. And I just feel that that's a place where you can really almost touch that dream. I was actually really lucky, and I when I was 17, just before I started university, I did an archaeological dig in Pompeii. So I was so lucky that I actually got to kind of have that experience of digging an area of the site that no one had ever dug before, you know, holding artifacts that no one had held since before the eruption, and just to be able to kind of be in the site in that way, that was a whole other thing. So it was amazing.
It's what you were saying about that kind of tactile experience.
Exactly. And especially because the way that we interact with the world, it is really tactile. And I think it's so easy when we're talking about stories to make it kind of, or myths and stuff, to make it kind of very ethereal and like, but actually kind of real life. In the ancient world, it was about the figurines of the gods and the goddesses that you worshipped and that you carried around with you, the clothes that you wore, the wool that you wove them from, the ceramics that you ate from. And I feel like that has always seemed in the past, especially when archaeologists were like looking for the kind of gold treasures and the kind of glitzy stuff. But I feel like we're now realizing the power of seeing individual ordinary lives. And I actually find that more exciting.
I have a few theories about the answer to the next question, but I'm going to ask you first before I tell you my thoughts on it. But why do you think the story of Antony and Cleopatra is one of the more well-known stories? And I mean that in the sense of, why do you think people have gravitated towards that story? You know, obviously Shakespeare.
Yeah, that was going to be my answer, Shakespeare. I was going to belly up. Bye, Shakespeare.
But why? why this story? That's the real question.
Yeah. Okay, so Shakespeare aside, I thought I got off lightly. Jeez.
No. No.
So there's no such thing as an easy answer, is there? So why Antony and Cleopatra? I think it's a lot of things. I think it's the clash of two civilizations, which always is kind of enticing and interesting to us from a historical perspective. You've got Antony representing Rome, and you've got Cleopatra representing Egypt. And so that kind of opposition of these two worlds, which were very different. Egypt had this kind of incredible rich heritage, history going back so far, these kinds of exotic to the Roman mind, exotic gods and Whereas the Romans saw themselves as this kind of very straight-laced, kind of from the earth, kind of hardy warrior society. And so these two very different values crossing against each other. Then you've got the potent mix of the fact that the Roman Republic at that point was crumbling and they desperately needed Egypt's wealth. And the two basically come together in the form of Antony and Cleopatra, and they implode and they basically destroy both of them. So you've got like the end of civilizations, which is obviously intensely dramatic. And that's kind of on the mega stage. And then on the micro stage, you've got this passionate love relationship that ends in an incredibly dramatic tragedy. So it's kind of like it's this swirling effect of history that is played on the microcosm between these two people. What's your theory?
Well, that was some of it, but also the dramatic way that Cleopatra actually died. With the snake. And
yeah,
even if it's not strictly true, even if it's not true that it happened exactly like that, that's the story that has been perpetuated and sort of trickled through everything to us talking about it now.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, like there's part of it which goes back to what we were saying about Sappho, about like, you know, a woman kind of needing to commit suicide because there's no other way for her to finish her story. So there's that kind of maybe difficulty to the suicide. But then the fact that it kind of goes down through history or with this asp bite, and especially that there's kind of one version of it that it was on her breast, this kind of incredibly exotic and erotic, and that's just like such a kind of potent mix. So yeah, definitely. And it's also just so theatrical. And I mean, if you see Sander's illustration, like he's got this incredible kind of snake swirling across the page, and then the two lovers kind of like dead on their couches, and it's just like, it's just, you can't miss the drama, can you?
I would say I love some of the, when it's in Suetonius as well, and in the kind of Robert Graves translation, when there's, he mentions a letter that Mark Antony sends to Augustus, where it actually says, "Do you object to my screwing Cleopatra?" And I just think it's hilarious. I had to mention that.
No, please do. It's brilliant. And Cleopatra brings out all of these crazy stories, right? Like the story of her kind of going to Caesar rolled up in a carpet, which like almost certainly didn't happen, but that, you know, makes a great entrance and when Elizabeth Taylor does it. So, you know, it's like all of these kinds of dramatic moments, and yeah, exactly. I love that letter as well. It's so great.
Well, obviously Shakespeare had the Antony and Cleopatra play, but their deaths gave me Romeo and Juliet vibes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know?
And I don't think I've ever heard about how Mark Antony died. Obviously you've got the way Cleopatra dies, and that's quite common and people might know that. But I don't think I've heard or looked into or was told about that. But do you think he was being quite dramatic?
Yeah, I don't know. It's difficult because dramatic, I feel like it kind of, yeah, puts that value judgment on it. I think to me, he was a man who had no options left. And suicide, you know, to us perhaps might seem like quite an extreme recourse, but actually in Roman culture it was quite a kind of normal way, and it was actually a very honorable way of dealing with a situation where you had lost honor, you'd lost your lost face. And to me, I think that was what it was about. It was realizing that he had lost the war, and he does this after a very significant defeat by the man who is at that point called Octavian, who later becomes Augustus, the first emperor. And I think he just has realized that the game is up. And in fact, you know, we sort of, and I think Sander's illustration has them both kind of dying on the couch together. And that's kind of at least how I heard it. That's how it normally happened, that they were sort of doing it together. But actually there was a gap between. So he killed himself first and she killed herself subsequently. So it's not kind of a pair thing. And which again also has Romeo and Juliet vibes.
As someone who gasped when she went through the gates and viewed the Taj Mahal, I love that you put this story in, the one of Shah Jahan and Mumtaz Mahal. You know, I queued up to go into there and see their tombs.
You're so lucky. I've never been. I would love to go.
It's one of the ones where you walk through and you, on the way there, you're like,
yeah, it's fine. It'll be all right. It'll be another like tourist spot. And you walk through and I genuinely gasped.
Oh my gosh.
And it's not just the Mahal. There's also like the Red Fort and there's all the places around it. And there's a huge gardens as well, mm-hmm. which is incredible. So why did you include them?
Well, for me, it was really important because this started as a project that was just about kind of the ancient world, which, you know, when we say ancient world, we mean Greek and Roman, which is so wrong because there was a massive ancient world beyond Greek and Roman. But this is kind of part and parcel of the kind of primacy that classics has had in the past. But it started about that. And it was really important to me to make it broader than that. So saying we're not going to just kind of focus on the kind of same cast of white Western people that we tend to think of when we talk about love stories and history. And, you know, look at this love story. This is kind of one of the defining love stories in history. It's one of the defining monuments. So why should we not have that one as well? So it was so important to me to have that in. I had to learn a lot to be able to write about it because it is beyond my area of expertise, but it was so fun to do it. And I just felt like it really enriched ancient love stories because it just brought this whole other culture. And I mean, you can also see it in Sandra's drawings that you just get this beautiful kind of whole other vibe from it. And it's amazing.
And can we just at the fact that they had 14 children together? That's a lot.
Yes. No, not just that they had 14 together. She had 14 pregnancies. I mean, I've done it twice and I would not want to do it 14 times. It's just like, wow, that is incredible. And I do kind of feel like, you know, as much as I love the romance of the story, I do feel it's a little ironic that, you know, she dies in childbirth with the 14th child and then she gets the memorial. I'm like, I feel like you could have had the memorial for child number 10, you know. But anyway, that's a sort of ironic aside.
She was clearly some kind of superwoman.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that 12 of these children were conceived while away with him on duty. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you can answer this because we might not know, but do we know if it would have been common for the queen to have gone along with the king, or would they have been expected to stay at home?
No, I do know that she was very unusual, that she wanted to be by his side. So there was a kind of expectation, and obviously there were multiple wives at that point. And so there was an expectation that they would stay kind of cloistered. Harem kind of just means something like sequestered or cloistered, away in these kinds of very luxurious apartments that were made for the wives of the Shah. And Mumtaz Mahal was unusual that she went with him on campaign. So I do know that that was definitely also kind of an expression of their bond.
So Prince Karan becomes Shah Jahan, and it's claimed he's a distant descendant of Genghis Khan. Mm-hmm. Was there any truth to this? Do we know if there's any truth to this? Or would people claim to be related to him to kind of improve their status? Because there's something that I've seen a lot in history and mythology. You know, people like to link themselves back to people of importance. You see it with the Aeneid.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. And so the Aeneid is definitely kind of trying to connect to the Trojan heroes. And I mean, there was a huge cultural currency in doing that, in demonstrating your ancestry, your right to be king. I mean, that was particularly true with Shah Jahan, because his kind of ancestors came into India from the north. And so there was a kind of attempt at sort of emphasizing legitimacy. In terms of the kind of whether it's provable that he was descended from Genghis Khan, I'm afraid I don't know. But I know that he was descended from a very well-known warlord who was one of the ones who was influential in kind of his family coming into India. But I don't know about whether that's provable. But mind you, Genghis Khan, I mean, his DNA is littered across the steppes, right, all the way from Mongolia into the West. So I feel like, you know, he definitely got busy.
Thank you just so much for coming and getting slushy with us. We didn't ask this earlier, but what made you gravitate towards all of the couples that you chose? Because you chose them from kind of really early on to moving past what we would consider ancient, but there's such a broad spectrum. And obviously then you chose Sappho, who she didn't have a specific romantic pairing that you mentioned, but it's more what she wrote and what that represented.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. This was a really careful process, and I took a long time over the selection because I was really wanted to make sure that that it was balanced in a lot of different ways. So I mentioned kind of one of the driving forces, which was that I wanted this to be not what you would expect of love stories, kind of pushing what we think about kind of traditional narratives, traditional boy meets girl stories. And so that kind of emphasis on diversity was really important the whole way through. Just kind of trying to change our mindset about the past and open our eyes to this. But then I also really wanted to include individuals from loads of different cultures. I just felt like that would be really enriching. So we have a couple from China. We've got obviously the Taj Mahal that we mentioned. We've got Ignatius Sancho and Anne Osborne, who are amazing. Ignatius Sancho was sold into slavery, but then he managed, well, he was orphaned and then he escaped, came back to England and was a servant, but became the first African man to vote in a British election. I just feel like that kind of emphasis on diversity was so important to me because I do also strongly believe that love is incredibly diverse and every love story is different. So that just really was a through line for me. So I had a list of, I can't remember how many, probably 40, 50 different love stories that I had researched from all different time periods. And I kind of looked at them from all different angles. You know, what kind of love are we looking at? What kind of story? What kind of drama? What culture are we looking at? What time period? And then I really tried to kind of draw as many different threads together as I could.
As someone who has written a book and covered so many love stories through different times, what for you makes a good love story for the ages? Kind of what does it need to have?
Oh, that's such a good question.
For you personally.
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, I was literally on a podcast earlier today talking about the hero's journey. And I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's like a narrative archetype where, you know, Joseph Campbell came up with this kind of series of steps that a hero has to go through in order to kind of like fulfill a narrative arc. And I kind of find that so sad because it's kind of suggesting that every story follows the same pattern. And I mean, there's obvious problems with it, right? That it's called the hero's journey and that's kind of idealized as a male journey. And so I just feel like, again, it's this kind of notion of diversity. It's that every love story is different and it's different according to each person. So I guess my answer, maybe that's a bit of a cop out, but it's that each love story reflects what each person and each couple, their challenges, their culture that they're living in, the thing that they have to, the obstacle they have to face. And I really feel like that, I love kind of identifying that. And that's what makes a great love story, because each person has their own thing that they have to face up to. And when you transcend that and when you find a person who will do that with you, that's your love story.
I think that's a cop out, because things that would have worked, the things that would have worked for just even looking at the stories that we discussed, things that worked for Antony and Cleopatra wouldn't have necessarily worked for the Sacred Band of Thebes, because they and their circumstances is so different. And I guess that's what's so exciting about the project that you've done, is that different people will be able to resonate with different ideas from different love stories and kind of find one that touches them in a special way that wouldn't have the same effect on you or me or Charlotte for whatever reasons.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So no, that's kind of exactly what I'm saying. But like, each of them has that kind of special ingredient. And I don't think you can narrow it down. I mean, maybe if you wanted to narrow it down, I think loss is a really strong one, right? Because loss sharpens that attachment. And so I think that you can see that that's a thread that goes through them. We've talked about the loss of a homeland in The Hanging Gods of Babylon. We talked about Sappho's loss of Anactoria and her hope to kind of reunite, and Hadrian's loss of Antinous, the loss of the lovers at Pompeii, and that kind of sense of our mortality and our fragility. I do think that really sharpens that. But then there's all of these kinds of individual other spices that kind of add into the mix that make it so interesting. And that's what's kind of wonderful about looking across history.
I learned from your book that I want someone who's going to do a grand gesture for me if I die first.
You need Hanging Gardens or Taj Mahal, one of the two.
Yeah, or loads of statues, like everywhere. I'll take that.
I know. I mean, and it's not just statues, right? Because he gets put on kind of medallions, like tourist medallions. I just love that. I'm just like, why would you put the image of someone else's dead lover around your neck? Like, that just seems
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you is the question. Absolutely. But I guess, Lauren, that's kind of your aim.
Yeah, that's what I want to achieve. And my boyfriend is not romantic, so that's never going to happen. But, you know.
Oh, God. Well, we've got it on record here. So
yeah, he can listen to this. Are you working on anything else exciting in the future that you can talk about? Actually, at the point we're talking to you, the book's not come out. We'll be releasing this episode for release date of the book, but mm-hmm. we know how publishing works, and yes. people plan things so far in advance that just kind of blows our minds sometimes.
It is crazy. I know. And it's difficult because, you know, you're working on a project and you're so excited about it, but you know it's not going to be out into the world for another year or two or so. Yes, definitely. So I do have a couple of things going on. So the first one is actually an academic book that's coming out next week, I think, which is I find it really interesting. It's called How Women Became Poets. And the basic idea is it goes back to Sappho. In ancient Greek, the language was gendered. And so the word for poet was gendered, and it was gendered male. And so when Sappho sang her songs, she had no word to describe who she was and what she did. There literally existed in the language no word for a woman who was also a poet. And so the book is basically tracing how that kind of vocabulary around men being poets kind of came to be, how it came to be reinforced, how that gender segregation happened, and then how when Sappho basically came along and broke the glass ceiling, men started to kind of try and come up with vocabulary to describe her, and then eventually when there were kind of more women poets in later periods, how they started to come up with a vocabulary, and Sappho does this too, a kind of different kind of vocabulary to try and articulate who they are when they don't have words to describe that.
That sounds really interesting, actually. Is it going to be available in regular bookshops? Where will people be able to find it?
Yeah, so I know it's going to be available online for sure. It's already on Amazon. I've scouted out the Amazon page. I know it will be in regular bookshops in the US from 22nd of August, and the UK, I think, from 17th of October, because they've just got sort of slightly different dates. But yeah, I think that will be in bookshops very soon. And then I do have another project which I've kind of just finished writing, which I can't talk too much about, but I'll just say it's been so exciting to write, and it's my first kind of proper public facing nonfiction work. So it's looking at women in ancient Greece, and it's sort of really trying to use history and archaeology to kind of uncover them. So it's been huge fun, and I've been traveling around all kinds of different places in Greece to kind of do research for it. So it's been great.
That sounds awesome. We'll have to check that out as well.
Yeah, thanks.
Are you on socials at all? Where can people go to find you and hear about when all of this is coming out and you can talk about it?
Yeah, so the best place to find me is on my website, which is emilyhauser.com. And I keep kind of details of the books on there. And then I'm also, I'm not on socials except for LinkedIn. So I just kind of do my professional stuff there. But otherwise, my website is the place to go. And there's also a form to contact me there. And I absolutely love hearing from my readers. So I love kind of when people reach out. I do loads of talks, particularly at schools. It's really one of my passions, is to kind of make classics accessible to particularly to young women. So I do loads of talks that at schools through my website, and it's just a lot of fun.
We'll put that in our episode description so people will be able to find you and contact you. Thank should you. They
that
want
would,
to
that would be great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for hanging out with us today, and again, special thanks to Emily. Follow us on Instagram at Demythifying the Podcast to learn more about episodes, and you can find us on Spotify, Audible, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you're liking what we're doing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Tell all your friends, it really helps us out. Check out our website at www.demythpod.co.uk. She's been Lauren, I've been Charlotte, and today we've been turning pages with Emily Hauser.